Hi, Greg Perry, the Historic Preservationist. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 11. Moving down the road a bit for our Colonial Craftsman series, heavily into those colonial trades. Going to move to the carriages today. Let's talk about the Wainwright and the Coachmaker. Okay. Wainwright. So, you know, like many a country blacksmith could build a satisfactory wagon or cart, pretty basic stuff for them. But in towns, some men devoted their whole time to the Wainwright trade. Roads extended, even if they didn't improve, after the first quarter of the 18th century. And a few men began to build lighter passenger vehicles for use on the roads. A farm wagon or a town dray in the colonies in the 1700s wasn't essentially different from a Roman wagon in the 2nd century. The only real improvement, the one-piece iron tire, may not have reached the American until after the Revolutionary War. The dimensions of a wagon resulted from ages of unconscious experiment and from the limitations of man and horse. Wheels were large for easy rolling on rough ground. Modern farm wagons, though, pulled by tractors, have often small, rubber-tired wheels that will turn under the body as the old wagon wheels would not. The hitch was placed at a height that would give the draft of animals their best pulling advantage. The height of the body from the ground was limited to the height to which a man could lift. The working parts of a wagon's running gear are its wheels, the axles on which they turn, and the axle trees that connect the axles, and, hence, the wheels in pairs. A long pole, called a perch, positions the axles fore and aft. It is fixed rigidly to the rear axle and is braced to it by the two angled hounds, hooping wings they used to call them. The forward end of the perch rests on the front axle, but is secured to it only by the iron king bolt, which passes vertically through both and on which the front truck can swivel freely for turning corners. Set across the hounds and the perch above the rear axle and firmly ironed, so to speak, to them is a timber called the bolster, to which the floor of the wagon body is bolted. There is also a bolster at the front, but the front wheels of a wagon are smaller than the rear ones. So, in order to reach the level of the rear, the front bolster rests on an additional timber, which is called a transom, and this is placed above the tip of the perch. The transom is part of the front truck and swivels with it on the kingpin. The bolster does not, though. It is fixed to the body. The hounds of the front truck angle ahead of it to hold the butt of the tongue or pole by which the draft animals pull. Hold back and then steer. Oxen use their yoke to pull the tip of the pole, while horses use collars and long traces to transfer their pull to the double trees held on the pole by a single bolt near the beginning of the wagon. Horses hold back by sitting in a heavy leather breeching connected by a harness to the pole's tip. The forward hounds perform a second job of steadying the front of the wagon as it turns. Behind the axle tree, their splayed ends are connected by some crosswise splay bar, which bears weight on the underside of the perch. Colonial America's great achievement in wagons was the Conestoga, though. The Palatine Germans in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, devised in about 1750 to haul their produce down to the seaports. They adopted their recollections of this big stage wagons, which they used to see in Europe, to the more rugged conditions of this country. They also developed a special breed of large horses used in teams to pull six of the Conestogas over very fiendish trails that eventually became roads. The running gear of a Conestoga was like that of a farm wagon, except that it was much, much stronger. The Germans made the wheels very high for easier running and to ford deep streams without wetting the cargo. The remarkable feature of the wagon was its body, but if you were to hear that it would serve as a boat, don't believe it. Both ends of the body floor curved upward to keep the cargo from shifting on steep hills. Its sides and ends flared out from the floor for the same reason, and also to gain carrying capability. The wagoner rode the left-hand horse nearest to the vehicle. On the later Conestogas, his helper rode the lazy board projecting from the side of the wagon, where he could reach the long iron handle of the brake. The early ones had no brakes, in fact. On the downgrade, the helper simply chained a wheel to keep it from turning. Most of the supply wagons that Benjamin Franklin hired for General Braddock in 1755 were Conestogas. Conestogas was a good mark, and they hauled flour to Valley Forge. They hauled freight between the new states. They hauled it to Pittsburgh and drifted westward in flatboats on the Ohio. They preceded the prairie schooner on the plains, and a few of them even made the terrible journey all the way to Oregon cross country, the new country. Wagon wheels were hard to construct. Only a master wheelwright could do it, and only he would have to have a blacksmith to help him, so they worked in a marriage or a great coordination. Many blacksmiths were also wheelwrights, though. A wooden wagon wheel had more or less barrel-shaped hubs from which a dozen or 14 or even 16 spokes would radiate to the wooden rims, which was shod on its outer face with iron. A hole through the hub was lined with a tapered cast iron tube called the box, which served as a bearing for the axle. In the early days, the axle was simply a rounded end of wooden axle tree. The shod on its underside with its through-shaped iron strip called the clout to make the rub where the weight rested. Later, the wood was entirely sheathed, and still later, even later in the century, in the early part of the 19th century, the axle arm was a solid forging made with an extension for bolting it to the axle tree. But ultimately, the two axle arms were forged on the ends of a single bar. None of these axles projected straight out from the wagon. They were all towed in, and they had gather. That is, they bent forward a very little so that the rolling on the road would tend to make their wheels stay on and reduce friction on the side tires. They also had to bend down somewhat to allow for the dish of the wheel itself. A wooden wheel isn't flat. Looked at from the edge, its spokes are, they seem to form a shallow cone, or at its apex, turn toward the wagon. This counters the side thrust of the load when the vehicle tilts, a force that will still turn a two-flat wheel wrong side out and will splinter it completely a flat one. The spokes below the hub carry the weight. As each one reaches bottom, it has to stand vertical to endure the stress. And to make that possible, the bent down axle tilts the top of the dished wheel just slightly outward. The hub of a Conestoga wheel could measure a foot in diameter by 18 inches long. Often it was made of black gum. The contoured grade of which helps make this is almost unsplittable. The wheelwright cut rectangular, even-spaced mortises around the midriff of the hub and shaped the tenon on the inner end of a particular spoke to fit each mortise and to fit it very tightly. To set the spokes in place, the wheelwright rested the hub ends on the sills of a narrow wheel pit and clamped them there with the number one mortise on top. He started the tenon on the matching spoke by tapping it lightly, then gauging his distance. He raised a long-handled maul, and leaping it into the air as he swung it full circle, he brought it down on the outer end of the spoke. So tight was the fit that it took two or three such blows to drive the shoulder flush against the hub. The rim of the wheel, whose hub measurements have just been given, is roughly 4.5 inches square, and is made up of seven curved sections which were called fellies, with their butted ends dowelled together. The fellies were not bent. A thin wood pattern was used to mark their curves on the side of a dress block of oak, and they were hewn to shape with an axe and an adze. The wheelwright mortised each felly to receive the tongues of the two spokes. He didn't shape the tongues until after he had driven the spokes into the hub, so as to avoid damaging them with his maul. The tongues went all the way through to the rim. Early ones were square and were slotted for wedges driven in through the face of the rim to lock them and to and make them help to hold the wheel together. Later, when a continuous iron tire did the holding, tongues became round and as did without wedges. Early wheelwrights shod their rims with stakes, which are curved strips of iron, each as long as a felly, nailed onto the wooden rim. Each strake bridged over the bent joint with two fellies, the wheelwright having pulled the joint hard together with a large threaded clamp called a Samson. Its operation can be better understood from a drawing than this description. It makes it very difficult. A blacksmith made the stakes and nailed them when red hot on the lower half of the wheel submerged in a Waterfield shoeing hole. As soon as he drove the nails from the stake, and with one left hand and the Samson catching the other one with the right, he spun the wheel to carry the hot metal underwater and quench it, cooling it. It shrank and drew its two fellies together extremely tightly. So just an ingenious method of joinery in the wheel itself. So even when the hoop tiring of wheels was commonplace, though the first quarter of the present century, watching the operation was interesting and exciting in itself. Most people now living were born too late ever to see it. Continuous tires probably originated in France. Even as late as 1884, tires had not wholly replaced strakes in rural England. In order to cut an iron strip the right length for a tire, the smith measured the wooden rim with a traveler. This was a 6-inch wheel mounted on a handled fork. He trundled it carefully around the circumference of the wheel, marking his start on both wheel and traveler, counting turns and chalking any fraction of a turn to the traveler at the end. He then ran the traveler the same number of turns on a flat bottom strip. For making a 5-foot wagon wheel, he cut the metal with his cold chisel and sledge, 3/4 inch shorter than the circumference itself. Many a tire must have been bent by the slow hammering of the hot iron. But a hand-cranked machine which would bend the iron was basically invented about 1825. The end of the strip had to be bent slightly with a hammer to start it. 3 rollers did the bending, 2 of them set some 16 inches apart. The distance was adjustable, supported by the tire on the outside. The third, usually the driver, pressed against the tire's inner surface between the two. It took 3 men to butt the ends of the tire to secure them together with a bent nail through the 2 holes so it would hold to the rim. Hanging the tire over the forge of the chain, they heated both sides of the joint, nail and all, swung it over to the anvil, and welded it together. The master checked the inside circumference for his traveler. Usually it was very tight, but if there was something wrong, by little as 1/4 inch, he scraped it and made a whole new tire. Nails, the same kind for the strakes, would be put through the tire and holes and had to be punched for them with the metal still red hot. Since the tire was smaller than the wheel, it had to be expanded to heat to get over the rim. The smiths built a ring of fire on the ground and placed a hoop on it. It took about half an hour to reach the necessary dull red. During this time, they put the wheel face down on a circular stone platform, pierced at its center for the nose of the hub to rest in. Apprentices filled sprinkling cans, one with each man, and distributed them along with three heavy sledges around the work area. The master and two journeymen lifted the tire with forge tongs and rested it on the rim, being careful to keep the nail holes between the felly joints, even expanded it too tight a fit to slip on. One side would go partway on, and the other side stood on the edge. The whole circle smoked in places the wood went aflame. The man on the low side held the advantage by pressing on the tire with his sledge. The other two swung theirs and drove the hoop down into place. As soon as the lower edge hit the stone, everybody grabbed a water can and doused the wheel. Steam replaced smoke with a great hissing, and a stench of charred wood resulted. The tire contracted violently, and the wheel snapped and creaked, and as it squeezed and tightened its joints and increased the amount on the dish. Sprinkling cooled the metal only partially. When the smiths hung the wheel on a temporary axle and spun it around in the shoeing hole, the water in the hole boiled, and the additional contraction squeezed putty out of the cracks, even out of the hub. The ironing of the wheel wasn't finished until the blacksmith had shrunk four iron bands on its hub, two narrow ones on the largest diameter against the bases of the spokes, a wider one, somewhat smaller diameter, on the inner end, and still wider and a still smaller one on the outside end. This last one had an inch-wide slot on its outer edge, matched to a slot in the wood to allow the removal of the linchpin that kept the wheel on its axle itself. After that, the job was turned back to the wheelwright for final painting. For the first few years of use, the tire nails served no purpose, but when the wood began to wear away under the tire and the grip that had been so powerful loosened up a bit, they came into their own, with very long wear both between the wooden rim and the iron tire itself, and the tire eventually, because it didn't start out as being round, became round due to wear. So almost from the start, farmers in the northern and middle colonies widened the trails to the nearest villages to get their products to market, and themselves possibly even to a church. In the southern tidewater settlements, where most were taxed by the water, some points were more heavily reached overland, and even if there was no road and just a trace marked by axe-cut trees, then these carriages were making their way through the hinterlands. So there is a paved highway in that area that is still called the Notch Road. So by 1725, widened trails radiated from towns and villages everywhere, and passenger vehicles suited to withstand their colonial holes and stumps, which were ever increasing. So by then, half a dozen centers were large enough for carriages to be useful within their limits. Chaises or chairs and gigs, but with two high wheels set very far apart, were the most readily to cope with the surface difficulties and difficulties, but even they upset frequently. There was no fundamental difference between chaises and gigs. The owner of the gig in front of the shop at the head of the typical pickup point in cities, all he would do is say, "Cheer," and people would unload into his carriage or into his two-wheeled vehicle. But this two-wheeled vehicle, some called a chaise a cheval, with its body hung on long shafts halfway between its wheels and its horse, called Frenchman as early as 1664. In an adaptation of the chaise a porter or sedan chair, the English copied it and modified it by moving its weight closer to the wheels. The Americans improved it further by enlarging the wheels and suspending the back of its body with hickory springs bolted to the top of the shafts. One like this was the original one of the wonderful one-horse shay. Speaking of sedan chairs, Negro slaves and sometimes Indians carried elegant American ladies in them on calling and shopping trips into towns. And Benjamin Franklin went about Philadelphia in one of these, when he was age enfeebled and a wheeled vehicle was plentiful over the rough for him. So he was carried sometimes, and longer distance he had a two-wheeled vehicle. So Boston chaise makers exported their product to the other colonies before 1735. By the mid-1700s, post riders began to carry mail from colony to colony with some regularity, and the routes they used soon became crude roads graded by the wheels of stage wagons carrying freight and passengers, and by those of private vehicles. The new invention of S-shaped steel springs from which to suspend bodies made travel barely endurable in cloud coaches and chariots, which were short body coaches for only two passengers, and wealthy men began to import them and to have them built in this country. So that was the beginning of coaches early on, about 1735 to 1740. So Nicholas Barry built both coaches in Philadelphia as early as 1740. Antonio Paddock of Boston, who began as a chaise builder, was making both chariots and coaches by 1758 and was selling them southward. Paddock was one of the artisans who was able to advance himself to wealth and a higher social status by building coaches. He held a number of civic offices, became a colonel in the ancient and honorable artillery company, and had the privilege of keeping a cow on Boston Common. Perhaps he was doing well and feared the effects of change. He didn't join his fellow craftsmen when they took fire for independence, but, along with many other honest men, remained loyal to the king. The revolutionaries made their disapproval of this so harshly clear that Paddock took ship with General Howe for Halifax, and his property was confiscated. So both coach and chariot were heavy vehicles. Their running gear was like that of a wagon, except that the perch was often bent downward to allow the body to be reasonably close to the ground. The enclosed body was framed of ash, joined with mortise and tenons, and spaced in the frame were filled in with thin panels of poplar, and the frame was rabbeted to receive them. The coachmaker needed skill because both frame and panels were curved, some of the most difficult woodworking out there. Some of his woodworking tools had special shapes and names to cope with these problems. Only one original chariot and two 18th-century coaches are known to survive in the United States: the John Brown Chariot of Rhode Island Historical Society, and the Beekman Coach in the New York Historical Society, and the Powell Coach at Mount Vernon. The Beekman Coach, long thought to be French, is English and dates from the early 1770s. The Brown Chariot, about 1782, and the Powell Coach, about 1798, were built in Philadelphia. A large coachmaker's shop employed quite a range of workers: wheelwrights, blacksmiths, woodworkers, trimmers, and upholsterers, painters, ironworkers. The ironwork on a coach was elaborate and highly finished. The bodywork was as exacting as cabinet makers. The whole interior of the body was lined with fabric, and the seats were cushioned. Both running gear and body got 8 or 10 coats of paint, each rubbed down, and then several coats of varnish, each of which was also rubbed down. And hence, you know, these coach builders are leading to the beginning, like General Motors began as a coachmaker's factory, the beginning of the automobile. But small wonder that Elijah and William D. Duquesne, who ran the largest coachmaking shop in New York about 1770, charged £165 for a plain coach and £200 for even a fancy one. The brothers built a coach for the Earl of Dunmore, probably an elegant one at that. Since he was so pleased with it, he persuaded Elijah to move to Williamsburg when his lordship went there in 1772 as governor of Virginia. Why Dean would leave an apparently prosperous business to set up in a smaller center is quite a mystery, though. But he did so, and he prospered there, and for the 3 years, he only had that left to live after that. But it worked out well for him. So we're going to stop there with coach building today. Greg Perry, the historic preservationist, I'm going to sign off. But I invite everyone to come and listen to our Instagram, the historic preservationist, all one word, all small letters. And that will lead you, that 1 minute leads you into 15 minutes of IGTV. So you'll see some of my videos in the antiquarian horological workshop, or the furniture workshop, or the furniture restoration workshop. So any one of those three, you'll find videos there. And also find us on our YouTube channel. And if you like what you see, please just hit the subscribe button. So Greg Perry, the historic preservationist, signing out. Thanks, everyone, again, for listening to this podcast.